From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now.
Una entrevista de televisión realizada sin mi autorización y que se prolongó durante 8 horas sería suficiente para evidenciar la crueldad y el daño que se le ha estado haciendo a mi hijo.
Politicians, journalists, lawyers, publicity agents, and others unrelated to the family have been harassing my son. An 8-hour television interview done without my consent has shown the cruelty to him and the damage caused.
Elian Gonzalez's father, Juan Gonzalez, arrives in the United States. We'll have the latest and oily politics and slick politicians, Occidental, Crown, George Bush, and Al Gore. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The father of Elian Gonzalez, in his first statement on U.S. soil, has demanded an end to, quote, endless confusing procedures in U.S. courts and that his 6-year-old son be returned to him now. Juan Miguel Gonzalez arrived in Washington, D.C. at Dulles International Airport with the aim of taking custody of his son.
Ha debido soportar el constante asedio de políticos, periodistas, abogados, agentes de publicidad y otros individuos ajenos a la familia. Una entrevista de televisión realizada sin mi autorización y que se prolongó durante 8 horas sería suficiente para evidenciar la crueldad y el daño que se le ha estado haciendo a mi hijo.
Politicians, journalists, lawyers, publicity agents and others unrelated to the family have been harassing my son. An 8-hour television interview done without my consent has shown the cruelty to him and the damage caused. My daily phone calls to my son from Cuba are often jeopardized, and when we do communicate, I clear hear the adult disturbing the child.
A profesionales, médicos, psicólogos, pedagogos, necesarios para la atención a los niños y que han seguido minuto a minuto la situación creada, y a un dirigente de mi país que como amigo o hermano ha estado junto a mí asesorándome y apoyándome en estos días de dolor y desconcierto.
I don't know who are the doctors and psychologists caring for my son or the treatment and medications he has been taking. Although on 4 different occasions I have submitted written requests for information, I have not received a response. In the last few days, my family and I have been alarmed to see the passion exacerbated in Miami and danger displays on television that make us fear for the safety of my son. I'm truly impatient to have him return to me as soon as possible and go back to Cuba together immediately. However, I've been told that I should still wait for 2 other months before I can take Elian back to his small hometown, Cardenas, where he was growing up well-loved and cared for. In the face of this new and unfair delay, I have asked the U.S. government to allow me to come here with a small group of Elian's classmates and teachers, as well as psychologists, pediatricians, and nurses who would help me care for him and assist those other children who have been following every step of the situation. Also a leader from our country who's been like a brother, giving me advice and support through our long days of pain and uncertainty.
Juan Miguel Gonzalez, speaking at Dulles International Airport, along with his wife and baby son. They have come to the United States to reclaim their son, Elian Gonzalez. And we're joined on the phone right now for just a few seconds by Jose Pertierra, who is a Cuban-American immigration lawyer in Washington, D.C. What happens now that Juan Miguel Gonzalez has arrived in the United States?
Well, I think what happens is that the Immigration Service will begin the process of transferring temporary care to him. They have indicated that they will give the family some time to do it, but not very much, that they are going to send them a letter indicating the terms of the transfer. And hopefully the family in Miami will comply and will voluntarily turn Elian back to his father. Bo Cooper, the general counsel of the Immigration Service, has been quoting as saying that if the family does not comply, then the Attorney General of the United States is prepared to enforce the rule of law. You can interpret that only so many ways, but I would think that if the family does not comply, then the Attorney General will have to implement the law as she sees fit.
We only have 20 seconds, but with the Miami Cuban group that basically went through the police barricade the other day as a sign of things to come, what can the federal authorities do?
Well, the federal authorities have secured far more dangerous places than Little Havana and Hialeah. I think that if they make a swift decision here and secure the place and allow the marshals, if necessary, to take the boy out and give him back to his father, and they have to do it quickly. It's almost like taking some medicine. You swallow your medicine a little at a time, and it tastes terribly. But if you swallow it in one big gulp, the taste isn't quite as bad.
Juan José Perteras, thank you very much for joining us again. Juan Miguel Gonzalez in the United States on U.S. soil now to reclaim his son, Elian Gonzalez. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. A Colombian court granted an injunction last Thursday to stop California oil giant Occidental Petroleum from drilling on the indigenous lands of the Ua people. The court determined that the drilling would violate the Ua's fundamental right to life. Occidental Petroleum immediately filed an appeal against the court's decision. For ages, Democracy Now! Has been trying to get Occidental's comments on their involvement in Colombia. In 92, the company purchased exploration rights to drill on Ua land. Public scrutiny increased in 1995 when the company was granted further exploration rights, and the Ua people threatened to commit mass suicide by jumping a 1,400-foot cliff if the company drilled on their land, which they consider sacred. Well, that was when many environmental groups got involved in the issue. Late yesterday afternoon, I was finally able to get Larry Mirage on the phone. He's vice president of Occidental Petroleum. He said he would give us just a few minutes midway through. Steve Kretzman of the Ua Defense Working Group also joined us.
Yes, my name is Larry Mirage. I'm vice president of public affairs with Occidental Oil and Gas Corporation in Los Angeles.
Could we start off by you just telling us what is the status of the of your case right now in Colombia? You're appealing an injunction to stop Occidental's drilling in Ua territory.
Well, the injunction named not only Occidental, but it named the Ministry of Environment and the Ministry of Interior. So there will be an appeal. Actually, an appeal has, in fact, been filed today. That is seeking to overturn the judge's ruling on this issue.
One concern has been whether the Ua were consulted on Occidental drilling on their territory. Can you respond to that?
Well, there are a number of reasons, a number of things that ought to be considered here. First of all, the actual drill site is outside the expanded Ua reservation. The government reached an agreement with the Ua last year to expand the reservation from approximately 268 square miles to 850 square miles. This makes the current Ua reservation larger than the Colombian state of Quindío, which has a population of 560,000. There are some 3,582 Ua based on a census which the government took at the during the negotiations for the expansion of the reservation. Under these factors would suggest that now the Ua are among the largest landowners in Colombia on a per capita basis. So first of all, again, the site is outside of the expanded reservation. And after a year-long review by the Ministry of Environment that also included a ruling by the Interior Ministry's Department of Indigenous Affairs, that there were no permanent indigenous settlements in the immediate of the actual well site. Therefore, there was no consultation necessary. After the various ministries had reached their conclusions, again, after a year-long review, because everyone was being quite deliberate and careful because they knew that there were some sensitive issues involved, the environmental license was granted by the Ministry of Environment, and then after that, Occidental moved forward with the initial work at the well site.
But did Occidental consult with UWA leaders?
I just mentioned very specifically that the ruling from the Ministry of Interior's Department of Indigenous Affairs that there were no permanent indigenous settlements in the immediate area of the well site, therefore there was no consultation that was required.
But considering the UWA have been so deeply concerned about this, wouldn't it make sense that the UWA be consulted, considering they feel that this is ancestral territory?
Well, the question of ancestral territory was resolved with the expansion of the reservation. The map, which was used by the government to draw the lines of the expanded reservation, was a map that the UWA themselves had commissioned from scholars at the Javeriana University in Bogota. And that map was used to draw the boundaries of the reservation. Every member of the UWA High Council signed the agreement, and Minister Meyer, upon the conclusion of the negotiations and the signing of the agreement, indicated that every hectare of land that the UWA had included in their map was included in the expanded reservation. That reservation, to put it in a U.S. context, is now 70% the size of Rhode Island.
Let me bring someone else into the conversation. It's been so tough to get Occidental on the line, and Steve Kretzmann just called in from the UWA Working Group in Washington, D.C.
I indicated that I would give 2 minutes, and I have really gone over my 2 minutes.
If you could just respond to his concern. Steve Kretzmann, are you on the line?
I am indeed.
Can you discuss your major concern with Occidental?
I think the major concern we have now is, as Mr. Mirage admitted in a meeting we had in the presence of Congresswoman McKinney last week, that Occidental has not carried out any consultations, nor has the Colombian government, with the UWA people regarding the construction of this well, the Gibraltar well. So what we're really calling on them to do right now is to suspend this project, to not file this appeal on this decision, and to suspend this project pending carrying out constitutional requirements under the Colombian Constitution. Are you willing to do that, Mr. Mirage?
Well, Steve, the appeal was filed today. Mm-hmm. And neither you nor I are legal experts on Colombian law. I certainly don't have a degree. And to make pronouncements on what is constitutional and what is not constitutional by either you or I is really not appropriate. I think this is a matter that is to be adjudicated in the Colombian court system, and that's where the issue is at the present time.
Yeah, it's pretty clear under Colombian law that consultation is required.
Under these circumstances, and it's far from clear. That's your interpretation.
By the way, I
really do object to the term admitted. You use that in your press release as well. Mm-hmm. You asked me, you were the one who asked the question, mm-hmm. and I gave you a very straightforward answer, very matter of fact, without any hesitation. Mm-hmm. And using the term admitted is as if someone is had been lying and is now fessing up to the truth.
Well, but
completely improper on your part to use that term, and I really object to that because I was, as I said, I was trying to be as frank with you and responding to your question as I possibly could be.
Actually,
I think I did that.
Mr. Mirage, I don't remember the exchange that way. What I remember is that you started off saying that, as you do all of your consultations with press and with public officials, that there have been many, many consultations with the UWA people.
There have been 33 consultations with the UWA people from 1993 to 1995.
Not one of them had to do with the construction of this well, did it? And so that, of course, is the matter at hand, and that's why I use the term admitted. I think it's disingenuous of you to be talking about those 33 consultations, which actually weren't with representatives of the UWA traditional authority, had to do with things like health and education projects, all sorts of process violations there around really what we're talking about.
Well, Steve, you were not at those meetings, and I fully admit that not having been a party to that, but you are speaking as an authority on this issue, and frankly, in 1995, 93, 95, you and your organization did not know who the UWA were.
It's true. International observers only became aware of this in 1996, which is, again, what makes the kind of statements that you've made about the UWA being manipulated by international NGOs, not to mention guerrillas, be completely outlandish. But because, of course, as the timeline shows, we got involved quite late.
Steve, you and I obviously have a very strong difference of opinion on this, and we're not going to resolve this in this discussion.
Well, let me ask you.
This is a matter that is going to be, again, adjudicated in the Colombian courts, and we are prepared to abide by whatever the final decision of the courts are.
Do you have a response, Mr. Mirage, to the indigenous lawmakers who are now on a hunger fast in Bogota, Colombia, protesting the lack of respect for the indigenous people and their land?
Well, I sincerely hope that the senators do not proceed with this action. We certainly would not wish them to in any way, put their own lives at risk. We would certainly at some point, these particular senators are not individuals with whom I've had any contact with, and I don't know about our people in Bogota, but certainly we hope that these senators reconsider the strike for the sake of their health and the people that they represent in their respective districts.
Steve Kretzmann, the response to this drilling being outside of UWA territory?
The drilling is clearly within UWA ancestral territory. Unfortunately, I only heard the end of what Mr. Mirage was saying about that. I can tell you that as regards the definition of what is UWA territory, that same study that Mr. Mirage referenced, the University of Javeriana study, also defined the ancestral boundaries of their territory and clearly put the entire Samore block within that. So there's not any dispute on that either for the same authoritative reasons that Mr. Mirage cited before. In addition, what Mr. Mirage, I'm pretty sure, didn't mention is that the land on which the drill site is actually located was fair and square bought by the UWA from local campesinos.
That's an issue too, Steve. That's very much as the subject of debate and doubt.
Finally, an Occidental Petroleum. This is the first time we have been able to get you on, and we've so often called, and Occidental does not respond to press calls to justify their position, which has further infuriated grassroots activists around the country that your power is in your money and in your alliance with the Colombian military. What is your response to that concern?
I object to that. Object to that characterization. I really don't have any comment on that. I think you have a particular ideological point of view which you're expressing, which you're certainly free to express. I certainly don't subscribe to your characterization of the relationship in that way.
Well, I'm just saying that it's always very difficult to get Occidental on to explain its position, but let me ask you about Occidental's relationship with the Colombian military.
I don't understand what the question is. What relationship are you speaking of?
Well, how reliant are you on the Colombian military to enforce the security for Occidental Petroleum in Colombia?
We have no other protection other than what is provided by Colombian authorities. We operate in an area which is dominated by both the major Marxist rebel groups, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and the National Liberation Army, which goes under the Spanish acronym ELN. We are basically an island out in an area that is surrounded by these guys. And it's a very, very difficult operating environment that puts people at risk. Our own staff in Colombia is 99.9% Colombian. This is an American company in Colombia in name only. The staff is made up almost exclusively of Colombian professionals and Colombian working people.
Does Occidental Petroleum give any money to the Colombian military to pay for security?
We are taxed, and the security arrangements in Colombia are made by the state oil company Ecopetrol, which handles that. Occidental doesn't have direct relationships with the Colombian military.
You mean you have a contract with Ecopetrol?
We have a contract with Ecopetrol, and they're responsible for providing security for the area.
And they pay the Colombian military for that security?
Well, there are army units that are stationed in the area without whom we would not be able to operate. Our employees are regularly subjected to threats and intimidation, as are residents in the area in general. It's a very difficult operating environment.
I guess the question then is, why do you continue to operate in such a conflicted zone when it seems clear after being bombed 700 times in the last 14 years that your installations continue to attract violence?
Well, you know, you've used that terminology, Steve, repeatedly about, you know, oil installations being a magnet that attract violence, and that's become kind of a mantra. If you really look at what's happening around Colombia, and you can certainly see this statistically, that areas where oil operations are being carried out are no more prone to acts of violence than other areas of Colombia where violence is endemic. You know, within the last 8 months, the ELN has begun blowing up transformers and power stanchions.
Larry Mirage and Steve Kretzmann. At that point, we got cut off, just a technical glitch, but Larry Mirage, the Vice President of Communications for Occidental Petroleum, based in Los Angeles. Steve Kretzmann with the UWA Defense Working Group, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll get further comment on this conversation and what is happening right now in Colombia with Occidental, as well as the UWA. We'll be speaking with an UWA chief, Human Rights Watch, and Steve Kretzmann. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We just listened to a conversation, a very rare conversation broadcast nationally, between the vice president of Occidental Petroleum, based in Los Angeles. The oil giant has for years been attempting to drill an UWA territory in Colombia. On March 30th, the Colombian government, or the court, issued an injunction against that drilling, saying it would violate the UWA's fundamental right to life. Occidental Petroleum has filed an appeal against the court's decision. We had a chance to talk with Larry Mirage. He said he was returning to a meeting and would have to go. Right now, though, since he couldn't join us live, we're going to go to a few people to comment on this conversation, among them Robin Kirk, who is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. I want to first hit on the last part of that conversation about the relationship between Occidental Petroleum and the military. Robin Kirk, what's your response to what Mirage had to say?
Well, I think I have two responses, one a sort of general one and one a specific one related to Occidental's role in Colombia and the current controversy over the drilling plans that they have and the opposition by the UWA. First of all, it is clear that the Colombian military continues to maintain a...
Robin, I'm going to interrupt for a second. Also on the other line, people may hear in the background some talking, and that's because what you're saying is being translated to the UWA leader who is on the line with us right now. We are joined by Roberto Perez, and I'm going to ask the translator to go off the phone when she does the translating so that we can hear you. Go ahead, Robin Kirk.
Okay. It is clear that the Colombian military continues to maintain a relationship with paramilitary groups, and that means a relationship that goes from simple tolerance to active support and even setting up paramilitary groups in Colombia. And these are the same paramilitary groups that are responsible for over 70% of the human rights violations in that country. So that continues to be a serious problem that the Colombian government has not addressed, and that certainly affects any relationship that any corporation or individual would have with the Colombian Army. The reason the Colombian Army uses paramilitary groups is because there are still officers within the military that believe it's the most effective way to combat the guerrillas. The paramilitaries obviously use dirty war tactics that are often assisted or even trained by the Colombian military. They receive weapons from the military. They receive operational support, intelligence, etc. So it is a very serious problem in Colombia. And I think when it comes to whether a corporation should continue to work in Colombia, it certainly should be a matter of discussion within that company about the risks and the implications of doing business where you have to depend on a military with a record of abuses. So I think that to date, Occidental has not really addressed this question directly and made clear what its human rights policy is in terms of its relationship with the Colombian military. That said, I think that in some ways, this dispute between Occidental and the UWA, there are some positive things about it that I'd like to point out. And one of those things is the fact that this matter has been adjudicated in the Colombian court system for many years. And I think that is one positive thing. That's what we want to see, is these matters worked out either in negotiation or through the courts. And not have any of the groups involved resort to violence. And I think that the Colombian government has tried to make some concessions to the UWA, for instance, expanding their reservation, letting the matter be appealed again and again, and currently it's being appealed for, I don't know, maybe the third or fourth time. And I think that is what we want to see happening out of this situation, is have the matter resolved through legal means and not through violence.
What has Amnesty or Occidental commented on publicly when it comes to pressuring the Colombian military to purge human rights-violating battalions posted around the pipelines?
Well, you would have to ask Amnesty that question. But in terms of what Human Rights Watch has asked, we've asked for the Colombian president to issue an order to the Colombian Armed Forces to discharge officers against whom there are credible allegations of human rights abuses or support for paramilitary groups. And we've also asked the president to issue an order that would prevent the military from disputing their jurisdiction over cases involving human rights abuses. Currently, military officers are tried before military tribunals and routinely acquitted. And so what we've asked the Colombian government to do is essentially use the powers of the president to ensure that the legal mechanisms that protect human rights are engaged. And so far, President Pastrana has not done that. And that, I think, is a major problem, both in terms of Colombia's reputation internationally for human rights and also the recent debate over U.S. military aid to Colombia. That was a major stumbling block, the lack of real progress shown by President Pastrana on human rights.
And right now, the Senate is considering approval of the bill put forward by the Clinton administration, more than $1.3 billion to Colombia, a large amount of it going to the Colombian military. Congress last week approved this bill. What's holding up the Senate?
Well, the Senate is actually shelved it for the time being. The bill, it was called an emergency supplemental, so it went outside the regular budget process, and what happened was the Colombia aid package got put in with hurricane relief for North Carolina and relief for the effort in Kosovo and various other things. And so what the Colombian aid package, which was, you know, in terms of the foreign budget, you know, a paltry $1.7 billion, got increased to over $13 billion in one emergency package. And so the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott, said that that's just too much money. I think the Republicans as a party and the Democrats as a party both support military aid for Colombia, but because the package had a big price tag at the end of the legislative process, Lott has decided or has said that he will fold the various parts of the bill into the regular congressional schedule, and we will see Colombia coming up again for debate probably in May.
Robin Kirk of Human Rights Watch. We're also joined by Roberto Perez, who is an UWA indigenous leader here in the United States in Washington, D.C. He'll be translated by Cassandra Smith. Roberto Perez, we just heard the representative of Occidental Petroleum saying that the map that has been drawn that shows that Occidental is drilling outside of UWA land was commissioned by the UWA people and signed off on by the UWA leaders. Is this true?
This argument of Occidental has always defended this artificial limit of our territory and not the real limits of our ancestral land.
Explain that.
Podría explicar.
Mire, el año pasado,
last year,
el 6 de agosto,
on August 6th, they granted us the unified reserve of the UWA people.
En la última que reuní, en la última reunión que nos reunimos con el ministro del medio ambiente,
but in our last meeting with the minister of the environment,
que es el límite único y es el
we did not recognize this as the final limit of our ancestral land.
En esa reunión nosotros manifestamos
in this meeting,
que el territorio
we expressed
ancestral,
that our ancestral land,
el límite nuestro es sobre Río Margo y eso más
has,
para,
is limited by the Río Margo, and this is
lo
the
que,
extent of our ancestral land.
Lo que nosotros estamos exigiendo
what
es
we're
el
demanding is the respect
y no
of
dentro,
our ancestral territory,
resguardo constituido.
And not just within the unified reserve.
Do you feel the Colombian government stands up for the UWA or sides with Occidental?
El gobierno está a favor de la compañía.
The Colombian government is in favor of the multinational company,
and
they don't recognize the fundamental rights, the right to life, the right to culture, and the right to the cultural integrity of the UWA people. These rights have been violated.
Y se han violado derecho de la propiedad comunidad sobre la tierra.
And also our rights to communitary property have been violated.
En caso con la invasión de la finca Santa Rita y Bellavista.
Specifically, I'm referring to the invasion of our two farms, the Santa Rita farm and the Bellavista farm, which are on the site of proposed drilling.
Y nosotros teníamos escritura pública
and we have
en Pamplona.
The deeds duly registered before the public notary in Pamplona of these lands.
Y no valió la escritura pública.
And
se viola la,
these deeds haven't been acknowledged and respected, and the community's right to private property hasn't been respected. It's been violated.
The UWA, Roberto Perez, UWA indigenous leader here in the United States, what do you believe the Colombian government has to gain by allying with Occidental? You're listening to Democracy Now!
Mire, yo creo que eso se genera más violencia en territorio nuestro.
I believe that more violence will be generated in our territory.
Porque siempre se va a violar, sigue siempre violando los derechos fundamentales.
And that our fundamental rights will be continued to be violated
y el gobierno
because Occidental and the government
hasta se puede comprar,
have enough economic power that they can buy people off
que están a favor de nosotros.
That are in favor of us, that are supporting us.
Pero nosotros vamos a seguir defendiendo
but we're going to continue
la vida
to defend
hasta la última
our lives
consecuencias.
To the
la vida hay que defender y la cultura.
We must defend our life and our culture.
How many UWA live in Colombia, in the area? This is in the northwest area of Colombia?
Nosotros somos ubicado en el departamento de Norte Santander.
We're located in the northern provinces of Santander Norte, Santander, Boyacá, Casanare and Arauca.
Somos 10,000.
We're 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Steve Kretzmann is also on the line with us, who is with the UWA Defense Working Group. Steve Kretzmann, you just listened to the conversation that you had with Larry Mariage. You also have been showing links not only between Occidental and the Colombian military, but between Occidental. You've been protesting his links to the company's links to Al Gore, the historic links first through Al Gore's father, former Senator Al Gore Sr., who is a major shareholder and office holder in Occidental Petroleum, which was founded by Armand Hammer. He has up to, what, $500,000 in stock in a trust fund in Occidental. Al Gore is known for facilitating the sale of Elk Hills in California to Occidental, the largest sale of public land in U.S. history. You protested in New Hampshire when he was running in the primary there. You're in Washington now. What comments have you gotten from the Gore office, and is he intervening here in Occidental's attempts once again to drill?
Yeah, well, despite over 40 protests around the country in the last 2 months, Gore's office has yet to respond to requests from the president of the UWA people, Roberto Perez, to meet with him on this issue while he's here in town. You know, I have had some conversations with staffers in the office, and they say they're working on it, but they're absolutely nonspecific on what kind of working on it they're doing.
As you reflect on this conversation that we had with Larry Mariage yesterday, the vice president of communications for Occidental, he talked again about this being as a result of, you know, where they're drilling, endless conversations with the Colombians and with the UWA. Your response to that?
I mean, you know, what are the conversations on? Again, you know, you heard him fold pretty fast in regards to, you know, the fact that, no, the conversations have not actually been on the drilling of this well. And, of course, that is what consultations are supposed to be. You're supposed to take consultations on actions that will affect the lives of these people. And, of course, the drilling of this well is the action in question, not, for instance, as Occidental has gone in and said, hey, we want to build you a small school, perhaps, although they haven't, or that kind of thing. You know, not, they have to go in and say, we're going to drill a well. It's going to produce X thousand tons of toxic waste. You know, it's going to do this and that and that to the surrounding area. And they've never done that with the UWA. And that's really, that's the legal requirement, and it's fairly clear. And that's what we're calling for as an intermediary step, if nothing else.
Roberto Perez, UWA indigenous leader, what will you do if the injunction against the drilling is lifted by the Colombian court? Roberto Perez, are you there?
We don't know yet. We will the traditional UWA authorities will define our response. They're the ones that decide what we will do in event.
When you heard Larry Mariage of Occidental Petroleum say that they have conducted many conversations with the UWA leaders, what is your response, Roberto Perez?
This is a terrible lie of Occidental Petroleum. Of the cited 33 meetings, they were all about scholarships that Occidental gives to UWA students. We only met with them twice on January and February, and the last meeting in Arauca. But in these meetings, they were just telling us and informing us of things. The UWA delegation was just present to listen and to take that information back to the community.
Finally, Steve Kretzmann, what are you calling for the vice president to do? And are you continuing protests at his campaign stops?
We are going to be continuing protests at his campaign stops around the country. And we're calling on him to use both his influence with this corporation, which is unparalleled. The Center for Public Integrity says there is no corporation closer to the vice president in the United States today than Occidental Petroleum. And his influence with the Colombian administration, Andres Pastrana, to intervene and really be a peacemaker here. I mean, we think of this as an opportunity for the vice president to show that his convictions for human rights and the environment are stronger than his connections to big oil. Here's his chance to prove it. Here's his chance to prove that campaign finance is not what dictates him. Here's his chance to make a difference. And so we're calling on people around the country to call on him whenever you get a chance and to give his campaign headquarters a call.
We are finishing up this conversation now, and we'll be switching parties here from looking at the Democratic presidential party candidate, Al Gore, to George W. Bush and his connections to Crown Oil and the quality of air in Texas. I want to thank you, Steve Kretzmann of the UWA Defense Working Group, a consultant with Amazon Watch, as well as Roberto Perez, UWA indigenous leader, and translator Cassandra Smith. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll put all their links, website information on our website at www.democracynow.org to get further information, as well as the Center for Public Integrity, which has published the book called The Buying of the President that outlines Al Gore's relationship with Occidental. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue on the issue of oily politics and slick politicians, this April 8th, workers, environmental activists, and civil rights groups are converging on six southern states to demonstrate at Crown gas stations. Crown Petroleum is the target of a national boycott after locking out more than 250 union workers at its Pasadena, Texas refinery 4 years ago. After the lockout, Crown replaced union workers with non-union contract employees and virtually eliminated African Americans from its hourly workforce. The company is also a defendant in a class action discrimination suit filed by women and African Americans, been the target also of lawsuits by environmental groups in Texas. In fact, Crown received the largest air pollution fine in Texas state history last year, $1.1 million. Meanwhile, the AFL-CIO and the NAACP have called for a boycott of Crown, and boycott supporters are criticizing the governor of Texas, George W. Bush, for his voluntary pollution reduction compliance program, which they claim lets Crown and other companies off the hook. Crown CEO Henry Rosenberg is one of Bush's campaign contributors. Last April, two locked-out Crown employees were arrested for protesting on public property in front of the governor's mansion in Austin. We go first now to Alvin Freeman of PACE International Union. That's the Paper Allied Industrial Chemical and Energy Workers, and one of the locked-out Crown workers. He's chair of the negotiating team between Crown and the workers. He worked for the company for 30 years. Why the boycott, Alvin Freeman?
When you do not get justice through the courts, it has been a long American tradition to turn to the people. I think years ago some guys held something called the Boston Tea Party. That has been a very effective tool for the underprivileged and the unheard of. Gandhi and Dr. King kind of proved that. So short of a violent revolution, then a peaceful boycott is the most effective tool to get the attention of major corporations. There's an old saying that they only feel the pain in their pocket. So the boycott is to create a shortage of funds for the company and gain some publicity to the public.
We asked Crown Oil to join us. They wouldn't, but they did fax us over this statement, a part of which I'll read. Crown is the object of a union strategy called a corporate campaign, which includes a smear campaign to discredit our company. Don't let your organization become a pawn used to achieve self-serving union objectives. This is a labor management issue, pure and simple, although the union strategy is to make it appear to be something else in order to drag you in on their problem. Don't make it yours, too. What's your response to that, Alvin Freeman?
Well, I can give you a short response and say it's a lie. If you call someone a bigot and they're practicing bigotry, then that's not a smear campaign. Let me just not deal with the past, which is horrendous because that's in litigation. The sister union has been locked out. Crown, by its own omission, has hired over 200 people because they have heavy turnover. And as of Thursday, there was two African-Americans in the plant. Now, let's use a little history on Crown Central. There has never been a Hispanic-American to retire from the Crown refinery. It is the oldest refinery in Texas, 80 years old. Why have no Hispanic retired? Because they just recently started hiring Hispanics in the 70s. Hispanics was in Texas before Texas was Texas. Ask them to give you an explanation for that.
Rosalind Norman is also on the line with us from the environmental group Texans United. She's a resident of Pasadena, Texas, the site of the Crown Refinery. What is it like living there, Rosalind Norman?
It is very disturbing to live here, you know, near this big refinery. I heard you mention about the memo that was faxed to you about Crown saying that this was basically something between them and the union, and that is so far from the truth, because as a citizen here, I can tell you that their pollution has affected this community. My family and my friends live here, and we just have a host of medical problems as a result of living here, where the toxic gases are spewing all over the community. We're suffering with problems like throat irritations and itchy eyes and congestion, bronchitis, insomnia, headaches from time to time. I mean, you can't even go outside and barbecue, you know, during the summertime because it just smells so bad. And if you wake up early in the morning, you can catch them, or if you're there, you know, in the evening, you can catch them where they let all this toxic waste out into the air, you know, when they think that, you know, people are not aware of it. It's just horrible to live around here. And we're all complaining about it. And how dare they say that this is just something, you know, between them and the union, when they know well, you know, all the health problems that they're causing here in the community, and how people in the community are outraged by it.
Well, Dr. Neil Carman of the Texas chapter of the Sierra Club, you are a former Texas State Air Control investigator. Crown Central Petroleum got the biggest fine in Texas history, $1.1 million for air pollution. So what's the problem now?
Well, actually, Crown has a very, very poor compliance history. And while the fine sounds like a big slap on the wrist, Crown actually made millions and millions of dollars by breaking the law on a daily basis for many years, from at least the early 90s until the late 1990s. They had over 15,000 violations of federal standards for sulfur dioxide and hydrogen sulfide gas, which are two very toxic air pollutants. And so basically, they were polluting the neighborhoods because of the problems they were having, and then they were not spending the money to fix their problems. They were, pocketing all those profits. So while the $1 million sounds like a pretty big fine, we had to, the citizens there in the area around Crown, and others had to put a lot of pressure through a citizen suit under the Clean Air Act to get the state agency under Governor Bush to hit Crown with a $1 million penalty. But the fact is that Crown made at least $12 to $13 million, as a conservative estimate, has an economic benefit of breaking the law year after year. So, you know, it pays to pollute in the case of Crown.
Dr. Neil Carman, you were a state air control investigator. Texas has the worst air pollution in the nation. What's the problem? Who's in the way of cleaning it up?
Well, you know, there's been problems for a long time, but I believe under Governor Bush things have gotten worse because the governor has received a lot of campaign contributions in his run for the governorship and also for his presidential campaign from big polluters. So basically, you know, he's accepted huge campaign contributions from the regulated industries that expect favors. And I think Crown is a prime example of how, you know, Governor Bush and the state environmental agency is willing to cater to industry rather than listening to the public when public health is supposed to be protected. The people living around the Crown Refinery have been begging the state agency for years to clean Crown up, and the agency was basically just willing to slap Crown on the wrist and allow the pollution problems to continue. One more point I would emphasize is that one of Crown's problems is a piece of equipment that they should have put in years ago to prevent these pollution insults from affecting the health of the community. Crown refused to do that, and the state agency under Governor Bush basically said, okay, we'll put a Band-Aid solution on Crown's pollution problems, and that's what they've done. And so we're basically waiting to see if that's really going to address Crown's pollution problems, but we're skeptical that it's just a Band-Aid approach.
The Texas Natural Resource Conservation Commission, known as the TNRCC, is it in charge of regulating these oil companies throughout Texas?
Well, it is. In theory, it's in charge of regulating.
And who appoints the members of the commission?
Governor Bush appoints the three commissioners who run the TNRCC.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring one last person into this conversation with Alvin Freeman, the union worker, one of the more than 200 Crown workers locked out several years ago, one of the people leading the boycott against Crown, Rosalind Norman, resident in Pasadena, Texas, where one of the Crown refineries is. Also with us, Dr. Neil Carman, former Texas State Air Control investigator. And now Rick Abraham joins us from Houston with the group Texas United. As we did in the last segment, looking at Occidental Petroleum and Al Gore, this connection between George W. Bush and Crown. Rick Abraham.
First of all, Crown Petroleum was one of the first 10 companies to jump forward and join Governor Bush's voluntary program. There was a news conference on the Houston Ship Channel, and the 10 companies, you know, pledged to reduce pollution.
The voluntary program.
Well, it's what Governor Bush and industry wanted was to continue a loophole in the Texas Clean Air Act, which allowed companies and their facilities to not to have permits and therefore not to have the best available pollution controls, not to conduct full health effects reviews on what their pollution was doing to the community. It was a way for some of the dirtiest, oldest companies to escape compliance with the law. And the public was fed up with that and was about to close that loophole, and industry and the governor got together and they came up with this concept of a voluntary compliance program. In other words, companies could voluntarily agree to do this, then we wouldn't need to change the law. And as I said, Crown was one of the first 10 companies to jump on this bandwagon and help the governor develop his environmental image. He could then say, you know, that he got the companies to voluntarily clean up their act without more laws and regulations. And we think that because Crown was one of the 10 companies, that they won the governor's favor and the favor of the governor's appointees with TNRCC. And then there's also the money. You know, we've researched and documented where Bush received $5,000 from Henry Rosenberg, Crown's CEO, over a number of years, and then his wife gave another $1,000 in 1999. And you know, someone else mentioned that Bush's campaigns have received a lot of money from industry. I missed the earlier part of your program, but I'm looking here at a report that says the Los Angeles Times study documented where Bush received $1.5 million from 55 grandfathered companies in his two campaigns for governor.
Grandfathered meaning?
Grandfathered meaning these oldest, dirtiest companies who do not want to have full air pollution permits. That's what it means. And Crown has grandfathered facilities, and Crown has contributed grandfathered pollution to the massive amounts that that Texas communities have suffered with. And the agency has, no question, the agency has gone easy on Crown. But in all fairness, we should understand that that agency historically has been lax on polluters. It was lax on polluters under Democratic and Republican administrations.
I want to end the conversation with Alvin Freeman, one of the workers locked out and chair of the negotiating team with Crown. You're clearly the boycott is having an adverse effect on Crown. In its latest filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Crown admitted for the first time the campaign and boycott could have a materially adverse impact on the company's future, talking about suffering a 7.4% drop in per-station gasoline volume. Can you tell us what the plans for April 8th are, Alvin Freeman, around the country?
The plans for April 8th is just to try to draw massive attention to the problem.
What will you be doing?
Just picketing, demonstrating, carrying signs, speaking to the public, asking people not to buy Crown gasoline. To say no to Crown means you say no to racism, means you say no to union busting, means you say yes to fairness. So this is just trying to get the word out. Vacation time is coming. The traveling season is coming up. So we chose April 8th to do a massive demonstration.
If people want to get in touch with PACE, Paper Allied Industrial Chemical and Energy Workers, to find out more about the protest, where should they call? The NAACP, the AFL, or your group?
If you're in the Maryland area, then you call 410-837-7906. That's S. Rothstein. If you're in the Atlanta,
I'm going to leave the number at that because we do have to end the show, 410-837-7906. We'll also put the websites on our website of Texas, Texas United. That's Rick Abraham and Rosalind Norman, as well as Dr. Neil Carman of the Texas chapter of the Sierra Club, which is joining in the boycott, along with the NAACP, Rainbow Push, the Sierra Club, AFL-CIO, the National Baptist Convention, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, and more. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Deepa Fernandez. Our engineer today is Matthew Finch. Our technical director, Errol Maitland, continues a slow recovery with heart damage after the police attack on him while covering the Patrick Dorisman funeral, the man killed by police a couple of weeks ago. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!